Good morning. Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. We're going to be talking in the latter half of the show to, again, Zafar Bengash, because all the world is focused on the unfolding events involving Iran, Israel, United States, and the Strait of Hormuz. And there are neighboring states that we need to know a lot more about, and Zafar Bengash is the individual who can best inform us. We're going to be trying to find out what the dynamics are. It is a worldwide issue, because I will emphasize this, that trade routes, sea routes that are there for commerce are somewhat at risk, considerably actually, not only in the Strait of Hormuz, but also now Panama. And there is also an area between Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore, where the U.S. military and others remind us that they could, if they wished, close off traffic, the sea lanes, close the sea lanes. And since we already have forces beginning to interrupt traffic, sea traffic, it's a dangerous, very dangerous situation. Of course, we all remember it in connection with the government of Venezuela, which is sitting in a jail in New York City. They're treating the former president, I shouldn't call him former, as far as I'm concerned, he is the president. Maduro is in custody there. He was kidnapped by a foreign state, which is heinous action, and was taken, he and his wife, to New York. And the American government has been issuing statements about what will happen to the oil and the traffic of ships to and from Venezuelan ports. I don't believe that we have been responsible in a way we cover this and talk about it. The wild, unspeakable, really, outrageousness of seizing the head of a sovereign country. And I don't think people who have been supportive of Venezuela over the years have been sufficiently alert and honest about what occurred, because many untoward things took place which should be accounted for. You know, we're not a family that hides events and refuse to speak of them. We need to actually know what happened, and we're quite within our rights to speculate. But we'll go into it in greater depth at another time. Just to illustrate, the U.S. at the moment is operating as though they actually have Venezuela under control. That seems to be in some people's minds a debate, but I'm not hearing any loud voices contradicting the President of the United States on this matter. An issue that I think that needs to be really brought to the attention of the Canadian people and all people of the Western states, all those populations and countries that made up the World War II alliance against Nazism and Japanese fascism. I want them all, I'm personally requesting, that they come to terms with some peculiar behavior, which is violating the terms of the conclusion of the war. There are people, of course, everyone grows a little cynical because you see them in the machinations of really great powers, and you want them not to do certain things, and you try to call them to account. And there's only one mechanism created by the world as a result of World War II, that is, the United Nations. Some people find it frustrating. However, I think that is actually what all of us are doing, if we're conscientious, is fighting for the principles that established the UN Charter and the political configuration of the United Nations, the General Assembly, and the Security Council. And these institutions need to function, and they need to be followed. If you didn't have the United Nations, by the way, most people who think they're informed and up to date would actually not know what is going on in most of Africa, most of South America, most of Asia, because there would be no occasion to actually share that information with the general population. The fact that there is a UN, a sovereign state, no matter the size, religion, or language of the people, can stand up at the UN as an equal and spell out what they think is important and what, how their existence is known or needs to be promoted or recognized or respected. They have that. And without the UN, you wouldn't not have that. There's the concern of the day, in my opinion, beyond other than the sort of shooting or near shooting crisis. Well, it is shooting. Actually, today there are reports that Israel is bombing again in the Bekaa Valley. Last week they had this horrendous story of a wonderful young journalist who bravely went to South Lebanon to report. She was told she would, if she did that, she'd be killed, and she was. I hope that that's being addressed at the UN, by the way. There's a situation that is not being minded properly, and that is the development in Japan. We have a new prime minister there, and the West really loves her because, of course, to show that they really approve of her, they call her the Iron Lady because we have the precedent of Margaret Thatcher. And so if you are in a developing country or a country far from the West and you're a woman leader, if they like you, they will call you the Iron Lady. But the Iron Lady, such as they name her, has been initiating some policy. I'm going to read this to you, because this is a statement last week, Thursday or Wednesday. The Chinese Foreign Ministry gives a daily, almost daily, 5 days a week, press review, and people from many papers, often then the Globe and Mail is there, the Bloomberg is always there. By the way, they're always antagonistic or smart-alecky, as you would expect, always playing gotcha games. Sometimes they do it together. There'll be someone from Reuters, he'll ask a question, the Chinese spokesperson will answer, and then the other will jump up and say, I want to follow up on that, I want to know why you didn't answer, blah, blah. So it's if you didn't know that, it does go on. The Chinese spokesperson are quite informative, and they must have all gone to the schools to train people not to be provoked. So here's what happened. The Global Times, which is a Chinese journal, asked the following. It is reported that one day after making ritual offerings to the Yasukuni war shrine, Prime Minister of Japan, Sane Takeichi, made a monetary offering to the shrine today. Minoru Kirishi, Japan's economic growth strategy minister, Haruko Aramura, head of the Liberal Democratic Party's general counsel, and several other cabinet ministers visited the shrine. What's China's comment? Believe me, This is Phil Taylor at Taylor Report. This is important. Guo Xiaoqun says in answer, "We've made China's serious position clear yesterday. Japan's negative moves related to the Yasukuni war shrine constitute a blatant provocation against international justice and an affront to human conscience. China is strongly indignant and severely condemns it." During World War II, Japanese militarists committed innumerable crimes, inflicting immense suffering on Asian countries, including China and the rest of the world. The Yasukuni war shrine is a spiritual tool and symbol of Japanese militarist war of aggression. It is, in fact, a shrine for war criminals, as it honors convicted Class A war criminals responsible for the war of aggression in World War II, including Hideki Tojo, number one war criminal and warmonger, Kenji Doihara, major culprit of aggression against China, Iwan Matsui, top perpetrator of the Nanjing massacre, Osama Nagano, order giver of the Pearl Harbor attack, and Kuniaki Koso, mass murderer on the Korean Peninsula. They are all major war criminals responsible for atrocities against the people in Asia and the rest of the world. The nature of the issue concerning the Yasukuni war shrine is whether Japan is able to rightly perceive and deeply reflect on its history of militarist aggression, and whether it can learn lessons from history and avoid a repeat of that part of history. This bears on the political foundation of China-Japan relations, on Japan's credibility as a nation, and on the post-war international order, as well as peace and justice in the world. The negative moves concerning the Yasukuni war shrine show that Japan, in total disregard of international concerns and just voices from both inside Japan and the world, has all along refused to acknowledge its history of aggression during World War II, attempted to change the verdict on its war of aggression and the Class A war criminals, and even gone further to challenge the judgment of the Tokyo trials and post-war international order. Lately, there has been a marked increase in the Japanese government's negative moves and reckless, provocative acts on issues concerning China's Taiwan region and the history of World War II, as well as military and security issues. Sanae Takeuchi's erroneous remarks on Taiwan have had a grave impact on China-Japan relations in the face of strong criticism and opposition from China, as well as at home and abroad. Some Japanese politicians and right-wing forces chose to go down the wrong path, rather than reflect on and correct their wrongdoings. The Chinese people in other countries, people in other countries that suffered under Japanese aggression, and all peace-loving forces for justice in the world will never allow this. This year marks the 80th anniversary of the beginning of the Tokyo trials. The militarists guilty of launching and executing the war of aggression and related crimes, thus upholding historical truth, international justice, and human dignity. Today, 80 years later, Japanese neo-militarism is rearing its ugly head and gaining strength, threatening to cast a shadow on world peace and security. The international community must respond resolutely to prevent any possible resurgence of Japanese militarism. Now, having read that out, I want to stress something here. Only a day or two after that was said at the press conference, a Japanese destroyer passed through the Taiwan Strait. That is to say, the Japanese destroyer was in Chinese territory illegally, and while they don't have a great navy, they're clearly working on it. And the U.S. is urging this on, just as it's a parallel that Trump has a game, and it's not just him. I probably should drop his name because this is basically U.S. policy and been going on now for years. It went on under Biden, went under Obama. The whole idea is U.S. hegemony, really. So it's either hegemony with a liberal face or hegemony with a conservative face, but they have encouraged they've been building the idea that they can't do all the heavy lifting, that while they are the world's policemen and they do have more aircraft carriers than all the earth put together, every other country, they do have 800 military bases around the world. They want and insist that now others start doing a little more of the work, and particularly the provocative work, the kind that might actually cause an explosion. So, for example, if they want to have a problem with China, they push Japan to be the one to do it so that they can say, well, you see, we're not directly involved. And after all, Japan is a democratic state like us, and that's why we have our military there to make sure we occupy Japan. But they say, so they as Chrystia Freeland used to chirp from her tree limb, we have shared values, same notions. Anyhow, so the U.S. has been expecting more of everybody. The U.S. said to Canada, for example, you're not even paying 2%, we want you to pay 5%. Into the military network that we've built and where everything purchased is from us and final say on how it's deployed, it depends on the U.S. Now we want you to put up 5, and everyone in Canada said that's not possible. And then there was a parliamentary joint backflip of several hundred members, and they all said, okay, we can do it, and we will do it. And then they said, well, you see, you have to get a little closer to our opponent, the Russians. So they said, yes, we'll do that. So the way we defy Trump is to do every damn thing he asks us to do. And we have soldiers in Latvia. What a wonderful idea. What could go wrong? Same with Finland. Finland's now our closest friend in Europe, they tell us. And the prime minister of Finland wants Canada to join the EU. There's another bright idea. The EU hasn't got enough problems, so now they want. And they would therefore would be locked into sacrificing personnel and Canadian treasure to whatever happens in the Baltics. It's considered very wise, and all the chin tuggers tell us it's the thing to do. So at any rate, they have the U.S. is insisting that these people call themselves middle powers, engage in a little more, put up more money to buy more weapons, put more people in the military, and then to behave in a provocative manner towards states with whom we have at least working practical relationships. So Japan is up, and they're taking the tarp off. They're beginning to show all those the flashy gear and the hardware. And Japan is beginning to argue that there's certain islands that are in dispute somewhat between themselves and Russia, and themselves and China are theirs, and they think it's that they need to put some missiles there. They need to put warships there. So that's a wonderful solution they've thought of. And this would please Washington very much, because that means that you don't have to use your own personnel to get near something that might blow up in somebody's face. The second aspect of it I want to mention is that they've done this also with the Philippines. The Philippines surrendered its sovereignty about a year and a half ago, whenever it was that the president, the most popular modern president in Philippine history, Mr. Duterte, the most popular, I'm going to stress that, a figure who was much more attuned to the ordinary life and attitude and spirit of the Philippine people. He was a very popular president, and he had a policy, and he said it loud and clear. He said, I'm visited from time to time by the Americans, and the Americans tell me that I have to take a hostile attitude towards China. And he said, I'm not going to do that. And when he said it, I was watching when he said it. This would have been 2018, 2019. He was standing at a podium, and the Chinese leaders were sitting at a table behind him, and they all nodded in appreciation, because he said, I'm not going to be part of a war. I'm not going to allow the Philippines to get drawn into some kind of conflict or pushed into it by the Americans. So what do you know? The Americans decided, and they picked up the phone, and the right people decided to charge Duterte with excessive use of force in fighting drug cartels in the Philippines. And then his term was up. He couldn't run for re-election. His daughter was possible. But at any rate, we won't go into that. So he steps down, and lo and behold, someone from the old Marcos family gets elected. And they come in saying, well, we're going to be just, you know, things are going to stay as they were. Well, they didn't stay as they were. Now the U.S. is once again stacking munitions on islands, Philippine islands. And there have been about once a month there's some type of incident involving Philippine military personnel and the Chinese, because you can always start a fight. There are islands that are in dispute between them. One of the ways to make it all go south and bad is to put your military or push it into a zone where it had not been, because it's a clear challenge to the other guy's military. So the Philippines is doing that. Most recently, the Philippine military participated in a joint exercise with, of all people, the United States and Japan and the Philippines. If you're China, you say, what are you doing? And they say, oh, we're just, you know, practicing. Well, look, let's go back to World War II. Japan has a constitution, and the world helped to write it. They said, look, the war is over, you surrender, these are the terms, you will have what they call a pacifist constitution. You will not build offensive weapons. You will not export offensive weapons. You will not promote militarism. you will condemn those who started the war in the Pacific and committed the massacres at Nanking and similar atrocities in Korea and elsewhere in Asia. You will not do that, and this is going to be in your constitution. And they said yes. Okay. Well, now we have a new Iron Lady, they call her, and she is quietly tearing this all up, and that isn't funny. And the problem is here is that the Canadian government hasn't said anything about it. Tojo was a name cursed, you might say, around the world for his conduct. And the prime minister sends funds to the shrine where Tojo rests. So Tojo is, you're not kidding anybody. We can see what is going on. But I don't understand why nobody in Canada seems to mind. I remember when everybody took their hats off and tears ran down their cheeks when they talked about the Canadian veterans, the ones who survived imprisonment under the Japanese, and they were so proud of them, and they, you know, we're so dedicated to our sailors and soldiers and flyboys, etc. Well, why aren't they saying something? They were killed, those who died. The executive authority was Mr. Tojo, and he was found guilty. There actually was a trial. Someday, by the way, we're going to talk on the Taylor Report about the trial. It's quite a fascinating subject. A little teaser is that at one point, Tojo said the emperor was involved in the decision to attack Pearl Harbor. And he went away from the court that day, and the next day he came back and said, I was mistaken. I should not have said that. That was not accurate. So that's a tease. We're going to go into that sometime. But the main thing is we don't want a revival of Japanese militarism. And I will say in the last portion of this section of the show, I think I maybe have a couple of 3 minutes, Duterte was basically kidnapped from his own country, Philippines, threw its sovereignty into the Pacific and permitted him to be taken out of the country. He didn't go in front of a proper court. He wasn't represented. They snatched him at an airport. He was returning from a foreign visit. They got him at the airport, and they snatched him, and he's on trial at the Hague. And the Philippines is confessing that it can't put its own citizen on trial for a drug case. So that's a farce. We ought to all be disgusted, but we're not. Why? Because most people are actually subjective. They're not objective. They don't care that he didn't get due process. They don't care that he won't be properly represented. They don't care that the Philippines ripped up its own sovereignty and surrendered him rather than saying, if he did these crimes in the Philippines, he has to face a Philippine court. No, it's not a big enough... It's not an adult court. It's a colonial court. They're doing the at the pleasure of the Western powers, and the sneakiest one of all being the U.S., which does not participate at The Hague. And so people are very, very sour that they don't participate. But they do help and assist to bring in people like Duterte. Incidentally, if you don't know it, the Philippines said that they were no longer part of the international court, and they had legislation doing that, and they even threw that in the drink. They said, oh, no, if it's for Duterte. And people here make their decision based on, do I like Duterte? So in other words, you don't care about rights. You don't care about due process. You don't like him. So if you are that sort of person, you belong in a mob. You and your friends ought to run up and down the street with pitchforks because you don't care. And all this West talk about Western civilization, due process, and courts and parliaments, people say, oh, I don't care what happens to Duterte. So terrible things happen. It's a disgusting situation. We're going to return to this subject in the future. This is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM. I think we have maybe a little Persian music, and then we're going to be talking to a very brilliant fellow, Safar Bengash.